You're listening to Something Rather Than Nothing. Creator and host, Ken Vellante. Editor and producer, Peter Bauer.
This is Ken Vellante with the Something Rather Than Nothing podcast, and I'm very, very pleased to have James LaBelle, Jim, author of Wheelchair-Bound Question Mark, memoir. And just wanted to welcome you to the Something Rather Than Nothing podcast, Jim.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here. I originally saw your podcast because you did talk with Elizabeth Copeland.
Elizabeth
Copeland is a mom of a friend of my son's. They went to elementary school together. So then I saw that and I contacted you and whether you'd be interested in looking at my book or not. And you said, yes, you want to take a look at it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so exciting to hear a connection to Elizabeth, and it was such a pleasure to chat with her.
Yeah.
So, Jim, tell us, I was thinking about before coming on to the show here, and I was like, I gotta have a better question. It was like, tell us about your life, because I just read your memoir and I just want to say off the bat, I deeply appreciated and enjoyed reading your story, and also to hear your life and questions of mobility and access, and you going to law school and travel. Right. Can you tell the listeners, you know, about your story? The accident, and just kind of what the theme is of your book.
Yeah, start a little bit at the beginning of the change, anyhow.
So.
I was 18 years old. I'd been out of high school for a year. The Labor Day weekend was just over. I was living in Minnesota. That's where I grew up. That's where I went to high school. And I was working night shifts, 11 at night till 7 in the morning. So I had a 650 BSA. I put a new set of handlebars on it, and I decided, I'd check out what they feel like and drove out to my friend Dave's, who lived about 30 miles away. And we ended up driving around in his car, picking up a couple of girls that he knew. And we went to this lake, a county park, Lake Independence, near the towns of Loretto, Maple Plain, and Minnesota. And the water was real shallow. We were wading around. We didn't have swimsuits, but, we just rolled up our pants or whatever, splashing around in the water. And there was a dock there. We weren't actually in the park. We were at a private property resort that was right next to the park. And I was up on the dock. And pretty much ever since I can remember, my parents have had a lake cabin. That's just something a lot of people in Minnesota do.
Yeah, yeah.
And I dove off that dock, ever since I could remember, and the water was shallow. And I knew this water was shallow. So I just took a run and I dove off the end of that dock. And the first thing I remember is floating face down in the water, and I wasn't able to twist my body or twist my head. I could see the sky. I could see sky, but I couldn't twist my head around enough to get air. And I'm just, struggling, obviously, trying to get some air. And, I have these real clear memories of the visions for many years. I mean, a lot of this I wrote down, and now I remember it because I've read the book and we're in the process of making it an audible book, and I've listened to it so many times in the last 2 weeks I practically have the thing memorized. But I have this little visions of me sitting in a fighter jet. I kind of always wanted to be a pilot, and I'm flying around in the clouds in this you know, single seat fighter jet. And then I also see myself just walking in the snow. And then I know I have this conversation with God. And then I pass out. Then I'm just gone. You know, I'm lack of oxygen, passed out. The next thing I remember, I'm laying on the beach. My friend Dave and the two girls were looking at me and talking. And I'm like looking up at the sky, and it's just this, you know, same sky that I saw when I was underwater, but it's so clear and blue and, you know, white clouds, and, you know, everything just felt actually really, really good. I mean, I didn't hurt at all. I had no pain.
Yeah.
And then there's this sheriff standing over me, looking at me, asking me like, what's wrong? What's wrong with you? And I have no idea what's wrong with me.
Yeah.
And I must have said I needed an ambulance, and they called an ambulance and they hauled me away in the ambulance. And I have actually no memory of anything about that ambulance ride. I've talked to Dave, and I think he told me one of the girls rode along in the ambulance, but, you know, I don't even remember that now. So, you know, then I was in the hospital, and I was told I broke my neck at the fifth and sixth cervical, and I'm a quadriplegic. I mean, I can move, you know, my arms. I can raise my arms. I can push a wheelchair. But I'm a quadriplegic because I have limited use of all four limbs. That's, you know, the quad. That's, so I have some of the muscles in my arms, but not all of the muscles in my arms. And that's, you know, from there on, that was September 2nd, 1969. And we'll be coming around, what, 55 years this coming September? Yeah.
Wow.
55 years this September. So the book kind of looks and ends pretty much at 50 years. And that was kind of my goal, to get the book done and make it through 50 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
And now I'm going to be 5 years past that.
Wow. So. Yeah, there's so much there. I wanted to ask you about, I want to tell you in reading your memoir, and
I'm really glad to, you know, get feedback from people. I still question the book. You know, most of my feedback is from people I know. I've gotten feedback. I started the Instagram account. Funny, actually, on almost the day of my accident, I just figured, you know, I was, that's kind of a long story there too. I tried getting a publisher to do the book. I thought my hook might be the University of Minnesota Press because I've got such connections there. And we talked back and forth quite a bit, but ultimately they decided the book wasn't educational enough. And then I just figured, I'm never going to get this book published unless I just go the self-publishing route. And that also has many, many avenues, and it took me a while to figure out what direction I was going with that. But one of my law school classmates has ALS, and he did a book, and I contacted him and got more information, and, you know, ended up going the self-publishing route, which I'm happy with. But yeah.
Well, it's on, what about the Audible bit right there? How did that get picked up?
That's something you're able to do on your own too. I think it's called ACX. It will be on Amazon, Apple, and then just Audible itself. But Amazon actually owns Audible, I just discovered. Amazon owns everything, basically, I guess. So, I mean, I didn't go with KDP, Amazon self-publishing. There's just different reasons why that can be, you know, a really good choice. And a lot of people, I went with a company called Ingram Spark, and a lot of people will do both KDP and Ingram Spark. I just decided I'm just going to do one of them. So,
yeah. Well, one, and it's great.
Yeah, where I was going, I guess now I just remembered, was like, getting feedback from people that don't know me. And feedback from people that have spinal cord injuries, but then also people that don't have spinal cord injury to, you know, see whether people think the book, how much effort do I want to put in marketing this thing? I guess is the question I still have in my head, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, I could speak it for me. You know, one of the things for me is, you know, just as a reader in reading the memoirs, like, we all have our ways that we come at the world, right? And I think the way that in reading your memoirs that for me, the university campus, where you're going to move to, is something on the first floor? Is there any ability to access this? How long does it take to get between my classes? Like, it really changes as a reader, really changes the whole topography of, like,
right,
of getting around and moving around in your travel adventures, right? I think it's reasonable to say. And then in other countries, and I was, right, my brain was really engaged on all that and thinking about those things. I'm a labor union rep in my day job. I'm an advocate. I do advocacy. Uh-huh. Right. So I very much think about these things. So for me, on the learning bit that you got, but I learned a lot about.
And I purposely tried to make it. I mean, that was one of my goals when I was writing it, to make it be educational. You know, so that's why I was a little disappointed University of Minnesota Press said it's not educational. But, you know, I think it's an educational book.
Yeah, I mean, what's a proper way to read? For me, a proper way with the memoir is that you're obviously going to, with the first person narration, the reader is going to engage with you and how you're trying to navigate through things. And I, like I said, the basic topography of how to live is such a big, you know, we go through your trials and how to get around. So for me,
I mean, now, you know, listen, like I said, I've been listening to it. Because basically I auditioned a number of people, picked out the person I liked their voice best. I'm doing it where he just gets a royalty on the sales of books, so I'm not putting any cash up front on this, so it's not costing me anything to do the Audible book. You know, if you're a person who thinks they're going to be selling many, many books, you may be more beneficial to just pay the person his hourly rate up front, you know, and do that, but I'd rather just not have more money invested in this book. And if we sell some, good. And, you know, if we don't, you know, I don't have to worry about it. But I have gotten response, especially from people with injuries similar to mine, at least three people saying, you know, we don't read books anymore because it's just a pain, because you got to hold the book open, keep it open. And we just listen to books. And it's surprising, you know, even both of my caregivers, who are, you know, adult age women, and they like Audible books. So maybe there's a much bigger market for Audible books than I'm aware of. But,
yeah. Oh, Jim, you know, I listen to a lot of audiobooks in Audible, and you know, working and doing this podcast, there's a stronger connection, at least over the last few years, to the spoken word. Like, there's just a, it's just like another way to access, and people really love it. So I was excited. I'm like, me individually, I was excited because I even like to read and then also listen to an audio version as well.
People have told me that also. I mean, I remember back when you used to get books and they'd be on cassettes.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you'd get a box with like six cassettes in it and it would be a book.
I still got some of those.
I did until I just gave them to Goodwill. So,
and then I bought them at Goodwill.
Yeah. Yeah, but my problem is I almost always just doze off or whatever when I'm listening to it. And, yeah. You know, now it's probably easier to go back and find your spot. But back then, it would be a nuisance to go back and figure out, you know, where you dozed off and how you're, you know, get back to the point where you remember hearing it. And but it has been. It's really an experience, you know, listening to Cody is the name of the man who's doing the Audible, listening to Cody read my book, you know, hearing somebody else read my words to him. I mean, I don't know what I was expecting, but I was surprised at, you know, hearing it. And I mean, it actually makes me emotional, you know, hearing parts of it, you know. And I mean, I know what is in the book. I, you know, also going through the editing process, I, you know, hired an editor, and, you know, that's a long process, but it definitely, anybody who writes a book really needs to get an editor, because without it, you know, she just made such good suggestions. I mean, she still tries to keep it, you know, your voice, your words, but just steers you on the right path and makes little suggestions like, you know, I don't know where we are anymore. Maybe you should just put in like, you know, this is a year later than the last time you're talking. I lost track of what timeline we're on, you know, simple little things like that.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about, I wanted to ask you an art question, but I'm going to ask it differently. I was thrilled about all your adventures around the world and you know, the different places you've gone to. And, I was just wondering, I got an art program, so it's definitely just the curiosity around it. What was your experience when you could contact art like around the world, and you know, were you able to access it, or what was inspiring of a particular location that you've been around the world when it comes to art?
Yeah, you know, certainly you're going to see a lot of things that you're not going to see at home, but you know, and myself, I'm not, you know, I look back on it now. And I, you know, I wonder why we even did some of those things. Like, you know, my friend Mark and I, he was just up here last week. And, you know, what made us think at whatever, 20 some years old, that we're just going to fly off to Europe and start looking around and seeing things. But you know, you talk about art, you know, I mean, I went to the Louvre in Paris, and I got to see the Mona Lisa, you know, roll up and down the hallways and see, you know, all of these famous things that you, you know, you've read about and you've seen pictures of, but, you know, part of me was somewhat disappointed because, you know, you've seen it and you're just expecting so much and, you know, but it's just a painting. I'm here and I'm seeing these, you know, statues and these paintings and these things that you've just read about, and just to, you know, be there. The same thing, you know, in those European cities, you know, whether it's Madrid or Paris or Amsterdam, just the architecture, the buildings, there's, you know, the windows and the doors, you know, everything is just so much older and so unique. You know, like I played around a little with photography and, you know, you try and get some images of, you know, like a stained glass window that you just thought was great. And, you know, your picture comes back and you like it, but it's just not the same as being there. You know, it's, I think in the book I even mentioned, and I was going through, you know, photos and looking at things, and I realized I'm looking at this one photo and it looks like the exact same photo that I saw, you know, a few days ago when I was looking at photos, and we went back and got an older album, and I've got these two photos of Notre Dame, and you can take them and put them side by side, and they were taken at least 5 years, maybe more than that, apart, and they look like the identical picture.
Yeah.
So, you know, I must have just really found some accessible spot on the other side of the river that was flat that, you know, I just like that particular view because it just seems so, you know, uncanny to me that I've got these two photos multiple years apart and they're framed almost identical, you know?
Yeah.
The way the picture's centered, the way everything about it.
About the experience writing the book and you know, creating your memoir.
Writing. You know, I have a lot of different stories, you know, I've always told stories. There's, so many different people I've met on this whole adventure, you know, 50 plus years of using a wheelchair, and I need people to help me. I mean, I'm not going to exist. I might exist, but I'm not going to have a good life unless I'm willing to ask people to help me, you know, do certain things. And I need help to live. So I've got to interact with a lot of different people. And, you know, so I end up with unusual different stories. And I mean, especially the whole Europe thing of just, you know, going there and thinking we're going to do it. And this is long before there were, you know, people with podcasts and travel agencies and telling you what's going to be accessible and what's not accessible. And I mean, we just went there and, you know, tried to figure it out, you know, and luckily we were young enough. And, you know, my friend Mark was strong enough that he could actually pick me up and carry me onto a bus or carry me onto a train or, you know, if necessary. We tried to avoid that, but, you know, there were times it just had to be done. But so I would tell stories. And then over the years, people are saying, you know, you should really write a book. You know, I mean, I heard that so many times for, you know, 25, 30 years or something. And I didn't want to write a book. You know, I didn't want to be one of those people that, you know, writes a book about their life because it's difficult. I mean, yeah, you're talking about writing, but I think it's really difficult to write a story about your own life without making like you're saying, you know, I'm something special or I'm, you know, look at me or, you know, in a way bragging or, you know, something like that.
Yeah. I know what you mean.
You know, and it's just, so I never really wanted to write the book, but then also I knew, and I say this in the book, the very 1 year after I was hurt, someone gave me Jill Kinmont. She was a famous skier and she had an injury very similar to mine, but her injury occurred, I believe in like the middle 50s. And then because she was a famous skier, a book got written about her. And I believe that book came out just a few years before I was injured. And someone gave me a copy of that book. And I read it. And it just stayed in my mind. It kind of helped me that she had this real problem. She wanted to go to school. She wanted to be a teacher. The University of California school system at that time wouldn't let her into the teacher's program because they said, you know, nobody's going to hire a teacher in a wheelchair. So why waste one of our spots on you? They said, if you get any school district that says they will hire you, we'll let you in the program. It was one of the Los Angeles, California schools. So she lived in Eastern California in the mountains, and she got one of the schools on an Indian reservation to say they'd hire her. So the UC system led her into the program and she graduated. And, but you know, just that whole kind of struggle that she's got an injury like mine, but she's gone to college and she's lived a good number of years and she seems like she's having a good time at it. So, you know, maybe if I can tell a story like that and, you know, I'm not trying to say like, you know, be like me, do what I did, but kind of just, there are possibilities out there. And, you know, there are things you can do and just, you know, figure out what you want to do for yourself. But, you know, it's so often disability gets portrayed as this, you know, really bad thing. I mean, you think of disability and you think that it's this terrible thing. It's the end of your life or it's, you know, the movies even that I talk about in the book, it's, you know, it's portrayed as a death sentence, you know, but there's a lot of things you can do. So, you know, just don't look at it as that, you know, that death sentence that, you know, it's this tragic, terrible thing.
Yeah. I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
I guess I sent you the link, but last summer I wrote this opinion piece that I felt really good about it. I got it published in the Minnesota Daily and, you know, I've had other things here and there, but I just kind of liked that one, you know, and it just, I wasn't even aware that there was, I mean, there's so many of these things. I think yesterday was International Wheelchair Day or something. I'd never even heard of that. But so I think July, if I remember right now from the opinion I wrote, July is Disability Pride Month. It comes after Gay Pride Month. And I just never thought of it that way, but I read a few things and it just, so I wrote that and I, it's just, when I think about it, yeah, people don't talk about disability and pride together that much, but, you know, I'm part of this group and, you know, we're recognized as, you know, there's different laws that categorize us as a group. And, you know, I'm proud to be in that group. I'm, you know, one member of that group.
I wanted to, I mean, it's such a difficult question, but I'm very interested in, you know, you mentioned 50 years of pushing on the book, and you said more towards 55 years right now. And, you know, for me, the way my mind is tilted is towards advocacy and how society is changing. Can you give how you feel about where we are now in 2024, like just a sense of improvements or frustrations that you have after this amount of time?
There's both. Believe me, there's a lot of both.
Yeah.
There's improvements, there's frustrations. I started the University of Minnesota in 1973, and it's just coincidence that that same year, 1973, they passed the Vocational Rehabilitation Act of 1973, which was basically a precursor to the Americans with Disabilities Act, but it only applied to any institution that received federal funds. So any institution that received federal funds was required to make their program accessible to people with disabilities.
Okay.
And it was interpreted to include all the schools and universities. It eventually was interpreted to also include private schools. Private schools originally, you know, I'm just making one up now, but we'll just, you know, pick out Stanford to pick on those guys, said that, you know, we're a private school. We don't have to follow that rule. But many of their students received federal student aid through federal programs, and the courts interpreted, no, you private schools, you know, you got to follow the same rules. So basically, all the schools have to make their programs accessible to people with disabilities. So that happens in 1973. But then the ADA, I should know this in my head, but I don't remember. I think it's been around at least 30 years. That basically says that all public accommodations, all transportation, public places have to be made accessible. But there's nobody out there going and, you know, enforcing that. The only way it's enforced is by people that, you know, take on a private lawsuit.
Yeah.
And I mean, I give lots of examples in the book that, you know, well, I just this week, I was making an appointment to get a CT scan, and my local clinic is not able to lift me onto the CT table. So I have to bring my son and one of my caregivers with to lift me onto the CT table, or take the ferry over. They can do it if I take the ferry over to Seattle, but that's a much longer day, bigger job, and it's just easier for me to get two people to lift me. To me, that's probably clearly a violation of the ADA, and I set it all up and was going to sue them, but it takes a lot of time, energy, and sometimes you just don't feel like doing it.
Yeah.
I mean, I know their defense is going to be that you can get it, you just got to come downtown. We've got it available, but I mean, I'm not sure that would actually work, because I know there have been lawsuits against clinics, and that's not an unusual thing. A person in a chair goes, and the doctor says, no, we can't lift you. We don't have any way to get you onto the table. And I mean, that's just going to, you know, how long has the ADA been around? And that stuff still happens, you know, pretty regular.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's a lot better, and there's a recourse, and you see a lot more. I mean, Seattle, I'm sure Portland, all the big cities, they've got wheelchair taxis that you can just call, and they're usually, you know, they're getting more dependable. I use them somewhat regular, so I, you know, don't have to drive over to Seattle. I just roll onto the boat and then have the taxi pick me up at the dock and run me up to the hospital, so I don't have to drive in the city.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's improvement, but there's a long way to go. And then there's still just attitude, and there's still society, and there's still a lot of people with disabilities, you know, have nice jobs. They go to work every day, and, you know, everything is okay. But, you know, from statistics, there's a lot of people that aren't employed. They're not able to find employment, or they're just not healthy enough to go to work every day. It's, you know, it's hard to manage your health conditions and go to work every day. And so you need some kind of assistance to pay for your caregivers. And that usually requires you to be on Medicaid. Right now, Medicaid only allows you to have, I'm not sure, it used to be $1,800 in savings. It may have gone up a little bit, but it's still pretty low. And there's just been this advocacy this last summer to, you know, let's raise that amount. So, you know, a couple thousand dollars might not even be enough to get your car fixed nowadays.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So if you don't have any savings, you don't have any backup, and you're stuck. So there's, you know, one of the person that I've messaged with a few times from Instagram is a man who has an injury similar to mine, but he lives in England, you know, so you've got very different systems in European countries. I mean, they've still got their problems, but, you know, you're going to have different financial support, is my understanding.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, Jim, about what I would view to be a complicated relationship with the law. I believe you're licensed to practice law in three states, went through law school.
Well, I knew I was never going back, so I let two of them just fade away. I didn't pay my dues.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm technically right now only an inactive member of the California Bar.
Okay.
So, yeah.
That's what I officially
am.
Yeah, yeah. It was well. I mean, in asking about it, is in coming through in your memoir, obviously a significant accomplishment. But for you, it seems to feel like it wasn't always like the right fit of what you wanted to do each day. Like you had the skills, right, but it wasn't, you know, what you wanted to do each day.
Yeah, and I'm sure that happens to, you know, plenty of people.
Yeah.
Someone right on our street here, their son, you know, went through law school, graduated from law school, passed the Washington bar, and, you know, after a couple of years, just decided he didn't like doing that. You know, it just wasn't for him. And I think now he's like coding or, you know, doing something with computers. He just, you know, but I don't know. You know, I'm not saying I don't like all of the things about practicing law. There were things that I enjoyed, and there were, you know, but, you know, it's just nothing. It's not something that I just had this big desire to, you know, like, man, I'm going to be an attorney. I want to be an attorney. I want to be a lawyer. This is something I've always thought about. I mean, I'll tell my son, and he says, you know, nobody does this. I just went to law school for something to do. You know, I just, and part of me too, you've got a disability and people look at you differently. And there's a point in time where you just feel like you've got to do something to show them that, you know, I can do this. It's, you've got to be this overachiever. You've got to be better than, you know, average, or you've got to do something like that. So, I mean, I wanted to go to law school. So, it would open some doors for me. People told me you don't necessarily have to practice law just because you've got a law degree. There's other things you can do with a law degree. And so I went there and I started it and I finished, you know, so.
Yeah. Congratulations.
And I've done it and it's okay, but it's not something that I feel I have to do with my life. And, you know, obviously now I haven't done it in, you know, probably 30 years or more. So, you know, there's very little chance I will ever do much with it again, but it helps me understand things. It definitely helped me be able to manage a lot of materials and understand reading. And, you know, a lot of it's even just helped me with my daily life. And I say that in the book too, because, you know, to get to where I am over 50 years, I never had any money. I didn't, you know, both of my parents had high school degrees and, you know, we lived just fine, but, you know, I don't come from a background of, you know, having money, and I've scrimped and saved a lot. And, you know, I've lived in federally subsidized housing for a lot of years. I've played by Medicaid rules so I could have money to pay for the people that assist me. You know, a lot of different government programs, a lot of Social Security, disability. And I had this big program with them and a fight with them for years and years to get them to help me buy a van. And then they changed their mind and they didn't want to pay for it anymore. So, you know, and just understanding going back to work when you are on Social Security disability, it's complicated.
Yeah.
And you've got to follow a lot of rules or you're going to get in trouble and have big overpayments. And then people get in trouble with that too. So,
yeah, it's to navigate that all. I want to ask a big, profound question, also ask some more details related to the book and people finding it. But I have to ask you the titular question of the show is, why is there something rather than nothing?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's taken me a long time just to remember the name of your podcast. People ask me and I finally got it down. You know, but once you remember it, you know, it's pretty straightforward. I mean, you know, I mean, I guess particularly with a disability in a life, you've got this disability that, you know, is going to stop you from doing some things. You're not going to be able to do all the same things you used to do. Even if you think you might be able to, or you can do some version of them, your life has changed. And I mean, you could look at it. I mean, all of a sudden you find yourself, you know, you're not able to walk. You're not able to use your legs. You don't, I mean, if you look at my hands, that's my hands. I can't move any of my fingers. And I mean, you know, but still I've got a little bit of pinch and I've figured out how, you know, I'll use a laptop, I'll use a tablet, and, you know, I've basically typed that whole book multiple times on my own. I'll use a little bit of voice recognition software now that it's finally gotten, you know, pretty decent.
Yeah, yeah.
But I still tend to just type stuff out, you know, one letter at a time. But, you know, you could look at that as just nothing. You know, your life is nothing. You don't have anything left. You know, what do you have left? But there is something there. And if you find it, you've got something, and you've got something that's enjoyable, and you've got plenty of something possibilities. So there's, you know, there's a lot of somethings, and it's not all nothing. And yeah. I mean, I think it works good just for disability itself. I mean, there can be something, you know, rather than nothing with whatever disability you've got. I mean, I talk about in the book, people in iron lungs. And I don't know why. I've just always been intrigued by
that. Was fascinating, that part. Iron lungs. Yeah.
And I mean, when I saw an iron lung myself for the first time, it's like, how could somebody live their whole life? And I mean, then I've seen these photos of whole rooms full of people in their iron lungs. And that movie Breathe, Robin Cavendish and then his son Jonathan made the movie Breathe. That to me is an amazing movie. I mean, I think it was the late 50s. He gets polio in Africa. He's in this hospital there. And his wife says, why can't we take him home? You can make this machine to help him breathe and we'll bring him home. And they bring him home. And they eventually gets, you know, back to England. They even fly back to Africa one time. I mean, of course, this guy has, you know, huge resources and money. They take his wheelchair adapted van from back then and put it in an airplane and fly it to Africa. But, you know, living with that, you know, respirator your whole life. But for the people that spend many, many years in an iron lung, and then those three that I talk about in that article that I read, they say they've got rich, full lives. They're happy. They've found something. And to me, when I first looked at that, I look at that and, you know, it can look pretty close to nothing. But they've found a lot of something, they say.
Yeah.
You know, and I've sent that article to a lot of different people and I've gotten different responses. And, you know, some of the responses are just, oh, that's terrible. But, I mean, I was really inspired by that article. I mean, I kept it for a long time and obviously I put it in the book even. You know, something about that people can find a lot of things that they're able to do with their life.
Yeah. It was striking to me as well. Everybody been talking to Jim LaBelle, memoir, Wheelchair Bound, ? Audible book. Jim, tell the listeners where to find the book and such.
You can go to your local bookstore. I like to support the local bookstores. You can go to your local bookstore. Again, it's Wheelchair Bound with a ? Because I don't like the word wheelchair bound. And there have been people that told me they don't want to even read my book because I use that word on it. But I remind them there's a ? Because I'm questioning the whole term that there really is no such thing as wheelchair bound. It's just, you know, might as well start throwing out the word ableist because it's got to come up somewhere here. It's just an ableist term. It's got this real negative connotation. It's years and years ago, I saw this cartoon where this guy's all tied up in rope. And I mean, that's what I think of when I hear wheelchair bound. It's,
yeah,
it's saying you're not able to do things. So I'm questioning that term. So you've got wheelchair bound. My name is James LaBelle. You go to your local bookstore. They should be able to order it for you. Get it, you know, 7-10 days, something like that. If you don't want to do that, you can go to Barnes & Noble. They can order it. If you don't want to do that, you can go to Amazon. And if you've got Amazon Prime, they'll ship it to you for free. Otherwise, you're going to have to pay some shipping. Or you can get it as a Kindle book, so you can just read it online, or not online, on your Kindle. You can read it through, buy it at Barnes & Noble, read it on your Nook. Or if you want to just buy it directly from me through my Ingram Spark account, you can go to bit.ly/buyjimsbook. But I didn't realize Bitly was case sensitive when I signed up for it because that was the first one I ever did. So the buy is capitalized. So it's capital B, U, Y, and then all the rest of it's just lowercase Jim's book. So the book, Barnes & Noble, your local bookstore, Amazon, any of those people, when you buy it, they get 55%. So I like seeing your local bookstore get 55%.
Yeah.
So.
And the.
Get the book. It's also on Kindle Unlimited if you have a Kindle Unlimited account. And like I say, I would say in less than a month, it's going to be on Audible, Apple, and Amazon Audible.
Awesome. So, yeah, that's what I was going to ask.
A lot of people have subscriptions to that, and then you can just get it there. So, yeah, so you can read it, Kindle, Nook. You should be able to get it pretty much anywhere ordering it. It kind of amazes me. Very early on, I sold 4 copies in Italy and a couple copies in Germany. And then I just sold one like a little bit ago in Switzerland. And then because of connecting with this one person on Instagram, I think I've sold like 8 paperback copies in the UK and a couple ebooks in the UK. So it's interesting to me that, I mean, they're all obviously just in English. It's not translated in any other language.
Yeah.
But in the first month or so, I saw that I'd sold books in Italy and, you know, Germany. So.
Well, congrats. Congrats on that. And it's good to, it is interesting. I even see it with the show where, you know, I'm like, who the heck's listening in Peru? But they do. And yeah. It's exciting sitting from wherever you are. Listeners, James LaBelle, recommend this book, Wheelchair Bound, ? And just like I said to you, Jim, just hearing about the bit about where there's the question about whether it was educational for me as an immersive reader is getting connected to this. I learned so much because when I read, I get pulled in and I'm trying to navigate, yeah, understand how to navigate with you. So I just find it even immersive in that sense. And,
I know that in the later chapters, it's a lot of my time where I've moved to Washington here and I'm being a single parent. So, you know, it's not about me doing big, you know, travel adventures anymore. Although John and I have done some, you know, good shorter trips here and there. But as I'm listening to it, it's, you know, it's a lot of day-to-day stuff. And I kind of wonder, but I think people like even just hearing how you navigate day-to-day stuff, yeah. You know, and there's, you know, things that just do come up that, and then I talk a little bit just about how different it is for kids growing up here in the 90s. And well, Sean was born in 93, so 90s and early, you know, 2000s compared to when I grew up in the, you know, 50s and early 60s. It's just, it's a different world, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's like, even when I was first injured, I'll mention, like, when I was first injured, there was no internet. There's no cell phones. There was no, you know, movie rentals. I mean, when you wanted to see a movie, I'd go to the movie theater or wait for it to come on TV on, you know, Sunday evening or something. Yeah. You know, it's like, you know, and a lot of that stuff has really made it better. That's another area where you talked earlier about the differences, you know, for people with disabilities. You know, voice recognition software is like so much better. And, it, you know, for people who have even less arm movement than I do, you know, they're able to, you know, just run all kinds of things just by setting their cell phone up properly, you know, and talking, you know, into their cell phone and operating things and writing things and coding and, you know, doing, you know, I don't even understand it, but, you know.
It works.
And cell phones are just such a safety thing. I mean, I just make sure I always have my cell phone with me if, you know, my van doesn't start or, you know, I just get stuck somewhere. You know, I can call somebody. You know, there were many years when I first lived in South Dakota on the Indian reservation and I was driving long distances. You know, you had a CB radio, but, you know, is anybody really going to be around? And I never even used the thing enough to understand how it even worked. But, I mean, I knew how it worked, but, you know, how I would get help with it.
Yeah, the CB radio with is there somebody on the other end versus GPS, potential GPS location. And
right.
Hey, everybody, listeners, make sure to check out Jim's work. And I'm very excited to hear about the audiobook. You know why? Because I like to listen to what I've read as well. Yeah. So I'll have that extra joy. And I just really wanted to thank you for reaching out, Jim, because like I said, it's been a very good experience for me and a learning one. And
anybody who does read the book, I really appreciate feedback. Whether you want to leave it on Goodreads or Amazon or, any of those spots, it helps me to hear what people got to say about the book. Because writing turned out to be fun, and editing was actually more fun than I thought it was going to be. At first, I didn't quite understand the whole process of, sending it, and she'd make corrections, and I can accept or deny the corrections, and she'd make comments, and I'd, add a sentence here or there, and then we'd go through it again after the corrections were made. So it was a long process, but it was fun. But I haven't found a lot of fun in marketing, but maybe doing podcasts. This is the first time I've ever done a podcast.
Here we go. Podcasts are fun. Their podcasts are fun. I started listening to podcasts a while back, and anything, they're mixed quality, but I tell you,
I definitely listened to a few when I've been in the hospital. One of the night nurses that worked 11/7 was pointing out this one that just had a big variety of guests, they totally different topics from one time to the next. And so, yeah.
Well, thank you for being on your first podcast. Probably many more, others to come. Pleasure meeting you, Jim, and thanks for
talking to you. I like your site. You get a lot of unusual stuff, so you get some good people and some good artwork and some.
I never know where it's going to go with creative folks, right? You never know,
but that's what's fun about it.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing, there's a lot of people with disabilities, also find that, they turn into artwork and, they'll really do some interesting artwork. And I mean, you've got people, I've seen people that, aren't able to use their, their arms or their hands, but they'll do these incredibly detailed, paintings, with just, using a brush or a pen or whatever, using their mouth and their head to paint with. And you're not buying it because they're an artist with a disability. You're buying it because it's a piece of art that, you really like.
Yeah.
I mean, I know this one woman that, was a quad and she painted and she didn't want people buying her paintings because she was, a quad artist. She wanted them to buy the painting because they liked it, but it's amazing what some of the artists do.
It really is. And, I think there's more discussion around it. I've had, singers, and artists on talking about, disabilities and conditions that really make it,
And that's where you were talking too. That's a big change to me in the last 50 years. I mean, you see people in, I think it was just like an Expedia commercial or a Target commercial. I mean, I think Target even this year had Christmas ornaments with a Santa Claus in a wheelchair. You just see a lot more representation out there in the world. And that's what I felt good about too when I was teaching at the 2-year college. It's good for people to, just see people in chairs out there interacting in the world. And, if you make the world more accessible, you're going to see a lot more people in the chairs out using it.
Yeah.
It should just, it shouldn't be unusual that, you know, I did all this stuff and I, you know, wrote about it, you know, but yeah, it's just, yeah, you should expect to see people in chairs out doing stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it has changed and it's inspiring.
And it's come a long way in 55 years.
That was the basis of, like, you know, the big profound thing, or just like, yes, such a span of time.
It's got a long way to go, but, you know, like I say, you see people in chairs doing a lot more fun stuff and, you know, enjoying life. It's, you know, it's not a death sentence.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much, Jim.
It was fun.
Deep pleasure talking to you. And hope to talk again soon. I'll be looking forward to that audiobook, like I said.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, bye, brother.
Sure.
This is Something Rather Than Nothing.
And listeners, to stay connected with us and our guests, visit somethingratherthannothing.com. Join our mailing list for exclusive updates and access to guest-created art. If you enjoyed this episode or any episode, please like, subscribe, and leave a review on your podcast platform. People really read that shit. Your support helps us reach more listeners and spread our community across the planet. This is a global show, and we like to give a shout-out to our many listeners across the world, including many listeners in Canada, Spain, Germany, UK, Argentina, Brazil, India, Thailand, and so many more places. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Something Rather Than Nothing Podcast for behind-the-scenes content. And the best way to help the show is to tell your friends about us. If you love it, they'll love it too. Tell your friends who love it. We love you. This is Something Rather Than Nothing Podcast.